number 31 in the book of 1 Samuel. We're in chapter 15 and be in verse number 9. In fact, we left off in verse number 9 last week, and I want to read that verse over again. As we came to the place of the sparing of Agag and the livestock among the Amaleks. Verse number 9, chapter 15. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and were not willing to destroy them utterly, but everything despised and worthless that they utterly destroyed. The Lord had told Saul to destroy everything. Instead, Saul and the soldiers decided to put a value on the spoils of Amalek. They separated everything into two piles. There was the pile of the best and the good over here, and there was the pile of the worthless and the despised on the other side. And they destroyed everything that was despised and worthless, but they kept the best and the good. And in addition, they did not kill the king whose name was Agag. As for the rest of the people of the Amalekites in Havilah, they destroyed them, but Saul did not actually fulfill the command because he did not destroy all the Amalekites in the land. As I told you or would tell you, they will show up during the days of Jeremiah and Isaiah. They will show up during the days of King David, and they will show up again in another place. And so Saul did not fulfill the command of the Lord to totally destroy all the Amalekites. But for sure, the one thing we do know in this passage is the king was saved, spared, and so was the best and good livestock. They were spared. Samuel was not camped with Saul or in that camp when the task at attacking Havilah occurred or after. We do not know where Samuel was, but probably he was at home in Ramah. But we do not know. Nevertheless, he was not so far away that he was too far away that the Lord could not find him. I often think about that in a wonderful way, that none of us are ever too far away that the Lord cannot find us. But more than that, we are never too far away that we cannot turn and see immediately and find the Lord. We now hear what the Lord said to Samuel in verse number 10a. Then the word of the Lord came to Samuel, saying, I regret that I have made Saul king, for he has turned back from following me and has not carried out my commands. Now, our translation uses the word regret, and I actually regret that it uses the word regret. When it says, I regret that I have made Saul king, today we define the word regret as an emotion of wishing that someone or we had done something with a different decision at some point in the past. We regretted making a decision. But I want you to know something. That is not what the word regret means in this verse. The Hebrew word is nakam, and it expresses the Lord's sorrow for what Saul had done. In fact, in the Keel Biblical Commentary of the Old Testament, it states about this verse, this does not express any changeableness in the divine nature, but simply the sorrow of the divine love at the rebellion of sinners. What he's saying there is, God knew what was going to happen. He did it on purpose. It doesn't change his divine nature that he knew what was going to happen, but it also expresses his divine love because he knew that it was going to happen and that Saul was going to disappoint him. Now, when we get down to verse number 29, this very same chapter, we will hear Samuel prove the point that the Lord does not change his mind about anything and does not need to. When Samuel says in verse 29, he will not lie or change his mind, for he is not a man that he should change his mind. Talking about the Lord. The Lord knew what Saul would do. He knew he would be disappointed by Saul, yet he made him king anyway. The word regret in our English does not express the proper definition for the meaning of the Lord's word regret here in this passage. The Lord is sorry that the king chose to be, that he chose to be the first king of Israel, did not carry out his command, but he knew he was going to be disappointed. Now I want you to understand this. As parents, we know our children. We know their nature. We know the way their minds work. We know how they are going to react and what they're going to do when presented with certain circumstances in life. Human nature is funny. As parents, because we know how our children are wired, we rarely rejoice when they do right. Oh, at the beginning of their lives, we rejoiced when they did right, but as time passed, right became expected and assumed, and we rarely rejoice when our good kids do things right. However, we also know that in this scenario where we could expect to be disappointed by them, we understand that even our good kids are going to disappoint us from time to time. But let me tell you something. When all the stars line up and we know our bad kids, if we've got a kid that's bad, they make wrong decisions over and over and over again, they're going to disappoint us with every one of their wrong decisions. And the disappointment brought sorrow and pain in our hearts. Yes, we knew all along that they would probably respond if faced with certain opportunities and certain facts. We knew how they were going to respond, and we knew they were going to be disappointed. We should not be surprised. We are never really surprised when you really want to think about it, because we know them. We know how they're wired. In fact, if perhaps they had made the right decision when we expected them to make the wrong decision, then we would be surprised. I cannot tell you how many stories I have heard in my office over the last 30 years where parents came in to seek counsel of how to help their wayward children, and their story began with these words, "It did not surprise me, but my child, dot, dot, dot." Fill in it. A literal translation of the Hebrew of this passage would be better translated like this: "I am deeply sorrowful King Saul has turned his back from following my commandments." He knew it. He knew he was going to do it, because that's God. But he's still sorrowful that King Saul turned his back. That statement shows the intent of the Lord better than in most of the English versions. Now, before moving on, let me interject that the Lord told Samuel much more about this whole situation than we know about so far. In fact, we will hear about the rest of the conversation that the Lord had with Samuel when he said to Samuel, when Samuel was probably at his home, say, "Listen, this is what Saul's done." We're going to read that in verse 16. But for now, we've got to go back to verse 10b. "The Lord was deeply sorrowful for that King Saul did not follow his commandments. And the Lord told Samuel." Now we come to what Samuel did when the Lord had a conversation with Samuel. Verse 10b. "And Samuel was distressed and cried out to the Lord all night." May we say here, the words of the Lord are not always comforting. Now we think of our Bible as being a book of comfort to the soul, presenting words that soothe and heal the soul. And the Bible does do that. However, the Bible is also filled with words from the Lord that are meant to churn us inside, to distress us, to grieve us, and therefore to move us to act appropriately as the Lord directs. In this case, the words of the Lord to Samuel distressed him all night long. I want you to notice that the writer tells us that Samuel cried out to the Lord all night. What did Samuel do? He prayed with the Lord all night. I imagine Samuel could not sleep a wink after he had heard the report about Saul. We come now to what Samuel learned when the sun arose. Samuel arose, verse number 12. Samuel rose early in the morning to meet Saul, and it was told Samuel, saying, "Saul came to Carmel, And behold, he set up a monument for himself, then turned and proceeded on down to Gilgal. Now, when the writer tells us that Samuel arose early in the morning to meet Saul, it means what it means. As soon as the sun came up, Saul got out of his bed and set out on a journey to go visit with Saul about his actions. And Samuel was more likely at his home, as I said, in his home in Ramah. And Ramah sat directly on the road from Havilah to Gilgal. Okay? Saul should have passed through Hebron, then Ramah, then on to Gilgal. Here it is on the map. I've got a map for us here, okay? Here's the Nile River. Here's the Jordan River. Here's the Wadi Egypt that we've spoken about. Here's the Suez tributary, the Wadi Suez, that Nebuchadnezzar is going to cut into a big canal. Later on, it's going to be cut into a bigger canal than that, that goes down the Suez Canal, down to the Sea of Suez, which attaches to the Red Sea. The Wadi Egypt tributary goes on over to the Sea of Aqaba, not all the time, only when it's wet. And here we have Beersheba, and right here around Beersheba, we have the city of Havilah, somewhere in here in this wilderness of Sur, just on that side of the Wadi Egypt. And here is the way of Sur that goes all the way up, and it goes through Havilah, through Beersheba, on up through Hebron, up through Ramah, and then you can either go straight or you can go over to Gilgal. But Saul did not go that way from right here. He went the long way around this mountain range that's in the middle here, over to Carmel, and then he came on the mountain range and had to go down into Gilgal, when the easy way would have been the normal road, not the rugged road, but the normal road that was well-trodden would be to go through Hebron and then through Ramah and then on over to Gilgal. By the way, Put, Egypt, Cush, and Canaan were the four sons of Ham, and that's the Arik. Now, Egypt's name also was Mizraim, and I've told you that too. And this is the four sons that they settled in this land. And this Wadi Egypt right here has been basically the division between Canaan land and Egypt land ever since the Tower of Babel, when the family spread out. Canaan landed here, Mizraim or Egypt landed here, Cush landed in what we would call Ethiopia next to the Red Sea, and Put in Libya that is right here. Okay, with all that in place, instead of taking the regular road through the country, Saul took the road around Hebron and around Ramah to get around, guess who? To get around Samuel. He knew. He was on the downward side of the slope, on the side over here that would go on down into the Dead Sea. You could go see the Dead Sea from the side that he was on. From the Hebron side and Ramah side, you can't see the Dead Sea. But from the Carmel side, you can. You can see that slope that goes down on that eastern side of the range. And he took his men to a town that is about 8 miles from Hebron across the mountains, southeast across the mountain range. And that town right there is called Carmel. Now, do not confuse that with another town called Carmel. Let me get a pen here. Another town up here with a place called, and I'll go ahead and write it in, Mount Carmel. Don't confuse that with this area, because that's way too far to the north. This is all in the area of Judah, tribal area of Judah. That is way up north. So don't confuse that, all right? This Carmel in this story is right here, all right? There is, and there in that village of Carmel, on that mountain range, on the side of the mountain range, Saul set up a monument to his success and to express his victory. Then he and his men took that rugged road less traveled on to proceed on down to Gilgal, which means when they were coming off the mountain, they could see Gilgal down in that area, that sandy area that leads on over to the Jordan River. The wording here is important. We do not live there. We do not know the terrain. However, when this was written, the Israelites of Samuel's day knew the terrain. And so will all the Israelites through all the rest of the Old Testament time. They will know this terrain and they will know these places. Anytime something is mentioned in the Bible, the Israelites throughout the whole Old Testament time knew where the things were. This phrasing in this verse tells us that Saul traveled that rugged road on the edge of the mountain range to the east of Hebron, to the east of Ramah, to the east of Jerusalem, until he could see Gilgal and go down that mountain slope to the area east, to that area right there. And by the way, Gilgal is just east of Jericho. Saul had gone out of his way to stay away from the home and the normal path of Samuel. To make matters worse, Saul had dragged along the king of the Amalekites and all the captured livestock and had them with him there in Gilgal. So Samuel left his home, heard that Saul was at Gilgal, and went to meet him there. And when we come to what Saul said to Samuel. What Saul said to Samuel. Verse number 13. Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said to him, "Blessed are you of the Lord. I have carried out the command of the Lord." Do you ever sit back and watch the ways of the sinners? Surely almost everybody in here, we know people who are sinners and they just sin, and we watch their ways. And I'm going to tell you, they're no different than what is being transpired and being said right here. I am always amazed at how sinners posture themselves after committing some act of sin. Saul is the perfect example. You can mark it on the wall. Remember this example because this is the way they act. To Samuel, Saul said, "Blessed are you of the Lord." Let us pause for a moment and think about the word blessed. I want to make sure we understand it. Do you know what it means? We use the word blessed or blessings often, but what does it really mean in the Scripture? Well, the word blessed has actually two meanings. One meaning is when it's associated with the Lord and what the Lord thinks, and one meaning is what's associated with man and what man thinks. When associated with the Lord, as it is in this verse, it means praised. It is an expression of approval. It's an expression of admiration. It's an expression of gratitude. It is an expression of devotion. All of those words express the meaning behind Saul's words to Samuel, that the Lord approves him. The Lord admires Samuel. The Lord has gratitude for Samuel. The Lord has devotion for Samuel. Okay? Now, all of those words express how the Lord feels about Samuel, and rightly so. Samuel was approved by the Lord. Now, if this was in a different case and it's associated with men, a man, or how men think, it means happy or favored, okay? Blessed is the man, or meaning happy is the man. Are you blessed? I'm happy. Are you blessed? Are you happy? I'm happy. It has nothing to do with what somebody thinks about you, approval, admiration, gratitude, or devotion. I didn't do that. It's just, are you happy? How do you feel? Are you happy? Are you blessed? I'm blessed. How does this fit with the acts of a sinful man? Sinful men seem to always begin their defense for doing something wrong with, get this, flattery. Saul was flattering Samuel when he said, "Blessed are you of the Lord." Flattery. He's flatterizing Samuel. So after the flattery comes the self-centered statement. Just get ready for it. It happens with all sinners. Saul was flattering Samuel when he said, "Blessed are you of the Lord." Watch out for the flattery, for when the flattery comes, because the next statement contains a lot of new non-truth telling. Okay? It does. Saul did not tell the truth, nor did he carry out the commands of the Lord. "I have carried out the command of the Lord." False. Flattery, lie. Samuel was not impressed with Saul's flattery or his statement. Samuel was not moved in his purpose of addressing Saul because of what he heard from Saul's mouth. It did not match what he had heard in the distance already behind him, because he could tell. He was hearing something coming from behind Saul. So we come to what Samuel said, verse number 14. But Samuel said, "What then is the bleating of the sheep in my ears, and the lowing of the oxen which I hear?" In other words, Samuel's saying, if you carried out the command of the Lord, why do I hear the sound of sheep? Why do I hear the sound of livestock behind you? The livestock should have been dead, should not have been carried along from here around and over to Gilgal. They should have been dead right there close to Beersheba at a village called Havilah. Samuel had caught Saul in a half-truth. Now, I just want you to understand. A half-truth is still a full lie. Remember when he discovered that Saul was a blame shifter in character, or we discovered that? Nothing has changed. He is still a blame shifter these two decades into his reign after we discovered he was a blame shifter 20 years before. Saul was caught. We now hear what Saul admitted in verse number 15. Saul said, "They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, but the rest we have utterly destroyed." Sinners. Here it is, blame shifting. They. The people did it. The people spared the best of the sheep and oxen. They, the people, they did it, not Saul. Then notice what all sinners do when they are caught in a lie. Saul did it the last time when we caught him as a blame shifter, and here he's doing it again. Saul is like all sinners. He tried to turn his sin into a good thing. And the way you do that in sinners' minds is you interject the name of the Lord your God. Saul's excuse was that the people did it because they wanted to do something godly with the spoils. It is all their fault, Saul is saying. It is all their thoughts, Saul is saying. It is all their ideas, Saul is saying. Oh, but Saul was not through with his excuses. He did one more thing to add. "But the rest we have utterly destroyed." What did he do? I want you to notice what all sinners do. They blame other people. They say it was their fault. And then they say, "But I fixed it." You see, he says here, "We have utterly destroyed them." Saul included himself in the destruction of what they destroyed. But we meaning I was part of it. Saul was not part of the saving of the best for good, for a godly thing. No, he wasn't. He wasn't going to take credit for that. But he was part of destroying the rest as he was ordered to do by the Lord. Now, when you see a sinner using flattery, followed by a false statement, followed by blame shifting, and then taking credit for some partial fulfillment of the Lord's command, watch out. A sinner is a sinner no matter how much of the commandment was fulfilled. If any part of the commandment is unfulfilled, the commandment is unfulfilled. That's what the words mean. They are left undone. Samuel was not persuaded by Saul's lies at all. He knew more about the situation than Saul did because the Lord told Samuel all about it that night at his home when Samuel was just conflicted and grieved and cried out and prayed with the Lord. We come to what Samuel proclaimed to Saul concerning what he had learned from the Lord the previous night here in verse 16 that I told you we would be at this in a few minutes. Verse number 16, "Then Samuel said to Saul, 'Wait, and let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night.' And he said to him, 'Speak.' And Samuel said, 'Is it not true, though you were little in your own eyes, you were made the head of the tribes of Israel? And the Lord anointed you king over Israel. And the Lord sent you on a mission and said, "Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are exterminated. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord, but rushed upon the spoils and did what was evil in the sight of the Lord?'" The Lord had prepared Samuel fully for this meeting with Saul. Is it not true, though you were the least in your own eyes, that you were made the head of the tribes of Israel? Samuel did not let Saul answer that question, by the way. But I can tell you what the answer was. The answer was yes, and Saul knew it was yes. And the Lord anointed you king over Israel, and the Lord sent you on a mission and said, go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are exterminated. Samuel did not let Saul answer that question either, but we know the answer, and so did Saul. The answer was yes. Why did you not obey the voice of the Lord, but rushed upon the spoil and did what was evil in the sight of the Lord? And Samuel paused at the end of that question to wait for Saul's answer. It was time for Saul to speak. And guess what? Here we are, Mr. Blame Shifter. We hear who Saul blamed, verse number 20. Then Saul said to Samuel, I did obey the voice of the Lord and went on the mission on which the Lord sent me, and have brought back Agag, the king of the Amalekites, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took some of the spoils and sheep and oxen and the choice of the things devoted to destruction to sacrifice to the Lord your God at Gilgal. Once again, just like before, Saul was a blame shifter. He shifted the blame away from himself and over to the people. He held his ground. He doubled down. It was the people's fault. It was not Saul's fault in Saul's mind.